Welcome back, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 5th of April, 2013, and you are tuned into the Geneva Business Insider, that monthly program where we break down the lies, obfuscations, scam schemes, and frauds of the central banksters and their political puppets. And we are joined, appropriately enough, for the Geneva Business Insider by the Geneva Business Insider himself, David L. Smith of GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com, which, as always, will be linked up in the show notes for this video / audio interview. David L. Smith, always great to have you here. Thank you again for your time.
Pleasure to be on. Thank you very much.
All right, let's get straight into it. This month, obviously, what has been the biggest story in the financial world over the past month would have to be Cyprus and what took place there with the raiding of the bank accounts of the poor put-upon holders, depositors in Bank of Cyprus and Laiki Bank. But let's talk a little bit about what actually transpired there and your take on what ended up coming out of that.
Well, my take on the situation, as we all know, there has been what the Troika are calling a bailout. If one actually splits it down into its component parts, it's not a bailout at all. Essentially, the money which is coming from the Troika, which is 10 billion, 7.5 billion of this is simply going to reimburse and roll over existing loans. And of course, the beneficiaries of that are the Northern European banks. There is another 2.5 billion, which no doubt they're keeping in reserve to make sure that any interest on future loans will be paid. So the genuine benefit to the people in Cyprus is absolutely zero. Then if we look on the other side of the equation of what is politely called a bail-in is little more than theft from private individuals' accounts. And of course, this was extremely badly handled because not only were they doing it from larger uninsured accounts, but they also were trying to take a swipe at the smaller people in direct contradiction of European law that the first 100,000 euros was guaranteed. So we're seeing a complete disrespect of any form of law by people who are essentially bureaucrats making decisions above the level of the sovereign governments of individual countries, which this is, you know, this is a tyrannical kind of a behavior. And then we have to look and say, all right, well, what does this actually mean for the individuals involved in the country? Well, there are two banks, Bank of Cyprus and Laiki Bank, or affectionately called Leaky Bank for obvious reasons, which are in very, very deep trouble. And there, the haircuts that people are going to take on their money. Sorry, once again, haircuts is a fallacious word because the theft that will be taken from their accounts is a very, very high percentage. Now, you can say in a way that the people involved have benefited over the last few years from having very high interest rates on their euro deposits compared to other banks. So they knew the risk they were taking and they suffered the consequences. And I sympathize with that in part. However, if you look at what happened over a number of days, from the time that the banks were closed in Cyprus, and as we all know, people were allowed to withdraw 300 euros and then down to 100 euros, 300 euros being less than $400. At the same time, of course, the wonderful administration overseeing all of this left the back door open in both London and in Moscow. So that the more wise and connected could take their money out the back door. And there was a list published of some of the amounts that were transferred in this supposedly closed period, which are absolutely monumental figures, running up to and close to a billion euro at a time. So the end result of that is the difference there, the shortfall, will have increased by several billion, which will be dumped onto the top of the poor people in Cyprus. And here I really do mean the poor people in Cyprus, because the others are not poor and they're no longer in Cyprus. And nobody is really making much noise about this in the press. And there is nothing easier in today's electronic banking world than to have cut those places off. So it was a deliberate orchestrated plot to allow a number of people who could probably have caused a lot of problems to slip through the net.
Well, hovering behind and above all of this specific event that's been taking place in Cyprus is the dreaded T word, template. Whether or not this will become a template for future Euro bail-ins and bail-ins elsewhere around the globe, and we've seen in recent days the discovery of some interesting wording in the 2013 Economic Action Plan by the ruling Conservative Party in Canada that seems to suggest that there will be bail-in possibilities should the systemic banking crises hit Canada in the near future. So it seems that this is an idea that is now in the ether and will be drawn on in the future. Can you speak to the possibility of this becoming something that will be raising its head in the wake of whatever future uncertainty we might see?
Well, I think it very clearly is the only solution that these guys can actually foresee. In Canada, you're quite right, the legislation is already in place. And between the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, there have been study groups have been working on this for a long time where exactly the same thing is envisaged. Now, if you imagine that Mark Carney is going to be coming over to England, I'm sure that the rules there will be changed extremely quickly to ensure that these kind of massive bail-ins or thefts from client accounts can actually be smoothly implemented within the framework of a quasi-law at least. So when Mr. Jisselbaum, or however he pronounces his name, said this, I mean, this is definitely a harbinger for what is coming everywhere. Because at the end of the day, the government's choices are quite limited. They can print as much bonds as they like. But as we're observing this morning in Japan, printing bonds doesn't always bring the joy and happiness that was expected. And it can be a situation which starts to spiral out of control. So what better way to stabilize the markets, if that's what we can call them these days, than by dipping into clients' accounts to re-strengthen your bank balance sheets? So, I mean, again, I come back to Cyprus for a moment, and you see tragic cases of people. One case that was held up as an example, a guy who came back from Australia with $1 million in his bank account, and was looking around to buy a house. And then a week later, he ends up with $100,000 in free cash and all the rest either absorbed in bank loans or bank equity. So, I mean, these measures are economically catastrophic. You know, the guy who at the end of the month has enough money to pay his payroll and then suddenly it's all swiped so he can't pay his staff. The human consequences of what they're doing is terrible, and what they're trying to do is make this a planetary solution. I mean, to me, it is tyranny in the extreme, fascism, if you like. But overall, it's a solution for to my mind, which is complete madness.
It is. It is almost the definition of madness. And yet, in a certain way, there is a certain twisted logic to it, because if the banks giveth, the banks can taketh away. And since most of the money that circulates in most of the economies in the world today is created by the banks through bank loans, I suppose they can just make them poof, disappear like that. So it is a tragic situation for so many people. And I guess this raises the question, the inevitable question, what do people do about this now that we know that we're living in this era where they're likely to come in and scoop out your savings at the first sign of instability? What can an average depositor who really does have savings in the bank account do with that money that will protect it, or at least help to protect it against this type of bail-in regime?
Well, I think the first thing to do is make sure for the smaller depositor that the amount of money he has in any particular bank does not exceed the insured threshold. Now, this doesn't mean to say that they can't have the insured threshold at a future date, but at least that is a safe precaution, and then perhaps have the accounts in the names of wife and children and whatever to spread the risk around a little bit. If you go beyond that, then you have to start saying that any money I have in the bank, is not there deposited with any sense of security. It's an unsecured loan to institutions which I know are probably bankrupt, can declare themselves bankrupt at any moment, and will have the government backing not to pay you back. So my personal view on it is to try and make sure that you've got as little money in liquid form in banks at all. And if you've got an investment portfolio, it's exactly the same story. Don't leave it with a bank. leave it with an institution, or you know, have certificates in your own name, or whatever. But get away from that system. Now, I think it varies from country to country how big and real the problem is. We can say maybe in Switzerland that the situation is safer, but we have two enormous banks whose balance sheets are something like four times the GDP of the country. And what risks are they taking around the world? I've really no idea. So even here, when everyone says, oh, yes, the safety flow to Switzerland, you have to say, well, what institution do I put it in? And having put it into any particular choice of institution, what is their relationship, for example, with a bank like a JP Morgan or a UBS or whoever? Because you do not know what would happen if UBS failed, what the knock-on effect would be for one of these other institutions which you thought were safe.
Well, if there is any silver lining to this, I suppose it is hopefully that more people will realize the real nature of bank deposits, which are unsecured loans. That is not money sitting in a vault somewhere in the bank. This is an unsecured loan to the bank that they pay interest for the privilege of borrowing your money from you. But you may or may not get it back, depending which institution you invest at which time. But you talk about knock-on effects. Well, there are knock-on effects going on all over the place. And of course, we've seen so much. We've been covering here the quantitative easing era that we're now so firmly ensconced in. And now let's cast our eye over to Japan, which you mentioned there earlier, where there are some interesting things happening in the bond markets. I'll just note for listeners that, again, this conversation is being recorded on the 5th of April, so things are still developing at this moment. But as we speak, it looks like the Japanese government bond 10-year, the 10-year bond yield is absolutely exploding in the last few hours. And the price drop in JGB futures looks like it's the biggest in 10 years. So this would seem to indicate that the big, amazing quantitative easing shock and awe from the BOJ and its new Bank of Japan governor, Haruhiko Kuroda, is not working. In fact, it looks like they're going to be biting a big bullet here. So let's talk a little bit about what this means and where things are likely to be heading here, not only in Japan, but of course, its knock-on effects around the globe.
Well, I mean, this is a very interesting development. I mean, for a while, the announcement has been out that that there would be significant quantitative easing. When you actually look at how much money is involved, you know, Japan's GDP is, if I remember correctly, about $6 trillion. It's about 40% of the U.S. So in relative terms, the quantitative easing that they're getting up to is twice the amount that they're talking about in the U.S., so it's a couple of the equivalent of a couple of hundred billion euro a month. dollars a month. So you know, maybe people are eventually going to get frightened, because if they look at the fundamentals of the Japanese economy, there are many issues at the moment. You know, there are aging issues in their population. There's stagnation. There's the inevitability of rising inflation, which of course is targeted at 2%, but who knows whether it doesn't end up being 20. There are lots of people who are actually needing to sell government bonds in order just to stay alive and pay their daily expenses. So, you know, for an interest rate movement of say 1%, the roll-on effect on say 10-year bonds in terms of value can be maybe 5%. So, it's very difficult at this stage to foresee the outcome. I mean, if I were in Japan at the moment, I would definitely be buying gold, because even in terms of, in terms of the dollar, it's going sideways or slightly down. In Japanese yen, it's hitting new highs. So, if you're stuck between the knowledge that your bank may steal your money, that inflation is going to take away your wealth and the exchange rates being destroyed, then you've got to start making a few serious decisions. Now, this, in a way, might be a positive thing short term for the dollar, because the dollar will be perceived once again as an inverted commas safe haven relative to sitting on yen. The whole thing indicates that the situation is utterly unstable and can fly out of control at any moment. And I do believe that the people sitting at the top of the Fed and the other institutions know this perfectly well, but they just see that it's the only game in town that they can play because they've played all the others and none of them have worked.
We've talked a couple of times in this conversation about gold and precious metals as a store of value and a hedge against the types of collapse that we're looking at in the quantitative easing era. On that note, of course, we've been following in Switzerland specifically the idea of the referendum that we've been talking about in the last couple editions of this video series. So on that note, we have this from the bastion of objective journalism, Reuters. Swiss right wing forces a referendum on banning SNB gold sales. And this is from March 20th. It notes, quote, "The right wing Swiss People's Party has gathered enough signatures to force a referendum on a proposal to ban the country's central bank from selling any of its gold reserves." And it goes on to talk about the idea of actually counting the reserves as well and finding out more about it. Of course, this entire article tries to frame it as part of this right wing crazy conspiracy type mindset that has forced this referendum. Tell us a little bit from the ground there in Switzerland what the real meaning of this referendum is and what's really happening as a result.
Well, I think the Swiss people have been waking up to the general pressures around, you know, with Germany trying to recover its gold and not being very successful in doing so, apart from getting drips and drips over a number of years. And Switzerland, you know, it's a conservative place, particularly in the Swiss-German area. And yes, it is a right-wing initiative, but the reality is that the support for it goes well beyond being right-wing or left-wing. It's an issue of where are the national resources. You know, the shareholders in the Swiss National Bank are all of the cantonal banks, some private individuals, and actually the cantons themselves. So there is a direct interest by the people in what's happening to the gold in the country. Now, I was involved in trying to get some support for this referendum, and you know, going across social classes, there is a view that people want to actually see what they've got. You know, show me the color of your money, literally. So, once you have obtained a referendum, you know, the consent to have one, it takes some time to put it together. It may take 1 or 2 years, the way that things grind on by the time they actually try to make the legislation, find the dates for it, take into account all of the arguments and counter-arguments. But it isn't really a right-wing issue, per se. It's a national issue. And I'm very happy that, you know, in a country which has a population of 7 million, you know, to get 100,000 signatures, you know, it's maybe 5% of the voting population. So that is not a bad effort. And it shows that the system of democracy, direct democracy in Switzerland, still actually has an impact, even although there are lots of barriers put in the way of it by the usual lobbying factors and those who don't want to have their power base cut or trimmed or to have any kind of scrutiny of what they're doing.
Well, it's always nice to see someone pointing out that the emperor has no clothes and forcing him to put something on. So we'll hope to see if this develops into that, and we will keep our eye on that. But as you say, it could take a year or two even to develop into the legislation that will eventually be voted on. On that note, anything else that you'd like to direct the listener or viewer's attention to this month?
I think we've covered the major issues of concern at the moment. As I say, I hope the situation in Japan stabilizes, but as we know, we're living on a knife edge at the moment, and if for any reason it doesn't stabilize, then things could get very nasty very quickly. So I think that people should be extremely prudent what they do with their money, where they leave their money in particular. As some comedian said, you know, only leaving money in banks that you're willing to lose. And certainly don't use a bank's or banknotes as a store of your personal wealth. It should be done somewhere else, somewhere safe.
Well, I have the front row seats to the BOJ's QE Follies, so I will certainly let you know how that goes. All right, David L. Smith, just tell people once again about your website and how they can find out more about your work.
Very good. My website is GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. I post approximately once a week there, either interviews or video interviews, radio interviews, or personal comments. You'll see there a direct link to my business website, and if I can be of any help to you, don't hesitate to contact me. Thank you.
All right, let's leave it there. David L. Smith, thank you once again. Looking forward to talking to you again next month.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.